Hello and welcome to Savor, production of iHeartRadio. I'm Annie Reese.
And I'm Lauren Vogelbaum. And today we're talking about imitation crab.
Yes, sometimes crab with a K.
Crab with a K, yeah. Annie named the outline for this episode just all in caps with a K. Crab.
Straight to the point.
Yeah, which I like. Right.
Yeah, yeah. I should have named it Mr. Krabs after my favorite SpongeBob character who does spell it with a K. Is he a fake crab? SpongeBob conspiracy.
I cannot tell you this because I have no idea what you're talking about. But I am sure that someone on the internet has either gotten to the bottom of this or pondered it deeply. So...
Oh, well, I will tell you, a couple listeners have written in and said, Annie, of course, you've seen the SpongeBob horror comic. And I had to, my shame, say, no, but share this with me. Lauren, even if you haven't seen SpongeBob, you should read this comic. It's terrifying.
Wow.
But fantastic.
Okay. Is it canon or is this fan work?
It's fan work.
Okay.
And it's about Patrick, like... being an insatiable, like, incorporating the actual anatomy of a starfish.
Oh, no.
And so they, like, cut off his arms. They're like, stop. And he's like, did you know starfish can regenerate limbs? It's so good.
Wow. Okay. Well, okay. So, I mean, so A, we have gotten a lot of requests for a SpongeBob-themed episode,
yes.
Which we will have to do in the future, for which I will totally watch some SpongeBob. I haven't not watched it because I'm mad at it or anything. I just haven't gotten around to it.
Oh, I got my list of, well, it's 12 favorite. I was supposed to do 5, but it became 12.
That's my the most anything episodes. I've ever heard in my life.
Yeah, a friend of ours was like, just send me 5. And then I was working on it, and I was like, can it be 10? And he was like, okay, but just 10. And I was like, well, it's 12. I'm sorry. But anyway, I got that ready for you.
Okay. So, all right. Yeah. Well, we can do this, and then I can read the horror comic, and then we can talk about it all in a future episode.
Yes.
But pending that, for now, Imitation Crab.
Yes, and this was a suggestion from listener Ben, so thank you for that.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of those foods I don't think I would have thought of doing unless, like, the news came my way or something, but I have no idea what it is, or I didn't when I started the research.
Right.
I could pretend to do the whole surprise podcaster thing, but no, I know what it is now, but I had no idea what it was, and it's very interesting and fun.
Yes. Yeah, and I will say that crab is one of my favorite foods, and imitation crab is a thing that I get, like, very specific cravings for. And this was, perhaps surprisingly to me, one of my cravingest episodes. Like, I came closer to ordering expensive lunch to be delivered to me during this than I have in a long time, and I feel kind of bad about that.
That's fascinating. Because I was thinking about this, and I've obviously had imitation crab, but I couldn't tell you what it tastes like. It's almost more of a texture thing for me.
It's
like
both.
I know the texture.
Both.
Yeah.
It's so salty and so sweet. It's not like food.
It's not like food. Well, you need to talk to Samantha about your love of crab, because I recently got to witness her love of crab.
This being Samantha, your co-host over on Stuff Mom Never Told You.
Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you. And it's insatiable. it's like, I've never seen anything like it. We actually went on a crabbing adventure. We'd already bought crab, had more crab. But she needed more crab.
Oh.
So we went crabbing, and then she had guilt dreams.
What?
About the crabs, but she still ate the crabs.
Wow. All right.
Yeah. Crab is also one of my mom's favorite dishes. And a couple of Christmases ago, I made one of her favorite things with crab as a sort of, like, let her down easy, I'm not coming to Christmas.
Oh, Yeah.
So I was going to spend it with my boyfriend. But we are going to do crab in a future episode because... I recently, because of this crabbing adventure and also because of some weird crab science I stumbled upon. Oh, my gosh. But not today.
Not today. I didn't have it in me for an anatomy lesson today. And
yeah, there's some weird, weird things going on with the crab.
Yeah. I'm so excited.
Yes. Yes.
But yes, this does bring us to our question.
Yes. Imitation crab. What is it?
Well, imitation crab sticks are the hot dogs of the sea, the craft singles of the ocean. They're made of fish meat mince or paste that's blended with binders and texturizers and flavorings and colorings, then pressed and cooked into these thin layers that are bundled into sticks resembling the meat from crab legs and resulting in like a tender, flaky, spongy, chewy, salty, sweet, savory stick of meat.
Stick of meat.
Stick of meat. Not meat on a stick. Stick of meat. Yes.
Oh, wow. Yes.
Important distinction. Here in the States, this imitation crab is almost always the crab in your California rolls, in your crab rangoon, your seafood salad, that kind of stuff. And that fish meat mince or paste is a product called surimi, which is also the main ingredient in fish cakes or kamaboko. You know, like the kind of stuff that you get in bowls of ramen or other soups in Japanese restaurants, a whole or in slices. Some of them have pretty designs like the Naruto kamaboko, which are white with a pink pink uzumaki, a pink spiral in them. Yeah. It's also the key ingredient in lots of other imitation seafood products like shrimp and scallop and lobster. And surimi is typically made from pollock or other whitefish because they've got meat that's mild in flavor and white in color. Though technically, surimi can be made from any kind of seafood or other meat.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. I think there's something about the fish proteins that work specifically well for this process, which is that you take your fish, you fillet it, you know, so it's missing the heads and the guts, and then press those fillets through a machine that pushes the meat through a sort of fine sieve, and then collects on the other side the bones and scales and skin. So you wind up with this fine mince of fish that you wash repeatedly and then refine and drain. At which point you've basically primed the proteins in the meat to coil up and gel up with each other. Then you freeze that mass until it's ready to be made into whatever kind of product you want. And the stuff that surimi is mixed with in order to create imitation crab may include water, starches from like wheat and corn and tapioca and potato or whatever, protein from soy or egg whites, vegetable oils, and thickeners like carrageenan or xanthan gum. And all of these things will help with texture. Then you're going to probably add some sugar and salt for texture and flavor, and then some natural or artificial colors and flavorings, plus preservatives for shelf life. The final product is going to be pasteurized for safety and sold to consumers either in packs by themselves or as an ingredient in dishes, as mentioned above. And compared with non-processed seafood, it is probably going to be cheaper, but generally less environmentally friendly because that processing requires a lot of water and creates waste.
Right. I found a lot of charts showing the price differences, and it can be significant.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
okay, but what about the nutrition?
Well, it depends on exactly how it's made, of course, but in general, imitation crab is low in fat, high-ish in protein, more carbs, and specifically more sugar than non-processed crab and fish. It's got a decent smattering of minerals. It is high in sodium, so watch out for that if that's a thing that you watch out for. And I mean, you know, if you're comparing processed and non-processed foods, for nutritional purposes, go with non-processed every time. But, you know, I'd say that the imitation crab will fill you up. In order to keep you going, you should pair it with a bit of fat, maybe some vegetables. Always eat a vegetable.
Always.
And there is a bit of a problem with the mislabeling of the composite seafood products that go into imitation crab. and other surimi-based products. Like, there's a mislabeling problem in all kinds of seafood. But yeah, if you have an allergy to any kind of seafood, I would advise probably avoiding imitation crab. In a study from 2017, over a third of the surimi products sampled were mislabeled.
Oof. Yeah. Well, we do have some numbers for you.
Yes, despite the fact that it is a little bit hard to parcel out numbers for imitation crab specifically versus surimi in general. But it's a big market. As of 2016, Alaska alone, not even the whole U.S., just Alaska, produced 204,000 metric tons of surimi, valued at $530 million.
Whoo! Mm-hmm. And Americans ate twice as much pollock as crab in 2010, which, again, hard to necessarily say how much of that has to do with imitation crab, but
probably a lot.
Probably. Probably. And the U.S. isn't the only big consumer. No, France, Spain, Thailand, South Korea, and Japan eat a lot of this stuff, too. Apparently, in France, it's pretty common to dip it in a sauce.
Yeah, I guess it's sold in little, like, snack packs, kind of, yeah, with a little sauce pack, and you just dip the stick in the sauce and you eat it as a little snack. And that sounds so delightful. And I'm like, why has that not taken off in more places? I want my little imitation crab snack packs everywhere I go.
Imitation crab snack.
Yeah. Yeah. It's available in claw and chunk form, which I found fascinating. Like, we only get the sticks because I guess yeah, we're just like, meh, what more realism do we need than a stick?
It could be a leg.
It could, sure. Why not? But yeah, claw form and specifically breaded so that you can just have a little crispy breaded claw snack, right? Okay. Those are frequently available in places like South Korea, Thailand, Spain, and Italy.
And comes in all sorts of flavors and colors in Japan, and sometimes given as a gift.
Yeah, Japan is the largest surimi market overall. There are special kamaboko made in different colors and patterns for different holidays. But the U.S. now supplies a lot of pollock and Pacific whiting surimi to Japan, like 99% of the whiting-based surimi used in Japan is from the United States.
Yes, and there is a very interesting history as to how we got to there.
Yes, goodness, and we will get into that, but first we're going to take a quick break for a word from our sponsor.
And we're back. Thank you, sponsor.
Yes, thank you.
So, for at least 800 years, surimi-based products have been consumed in Japan. The first known recipe for the process of manufacturing surimi, traditionally known as, yes, kamaboko, goes back to a 1528 cookbook. It was a way to use up leftover or extra fish by grinding it up and salting it, and in some instances, it was considered a delicacy. Mm-hmm. In the 19th century, small commercial businesses started selling surimi-based products, and in the 20th century, with the advent of more efficient, large-scale fishing operations, modern manufacturing processes of surimi-based products were born. Mm-hmm. Japanese scientists innovated most of these methods between 1945 and 1960. Things like longer preservation for improved shelf life, improving the texture, and learning more about the gel-forming properties and why they happen, and from that, how to improve the texture after freezing.
Yeah, the problem is that fresh surimi only lasts for so long, you know, because it's a fresh product. But freezing proteins, which is, you know, a good solution for preservation, freezing them can denature them. It makes them uncurl, so they won't form and gel up with each other properly. A major innovation was the addition of sucrose and sorbitol, which are sweeteners that also protect the microscopic structures within the surimi when it's frozen. It helps those proteins avoid denaturing. And this meant that you could make all the surimi you wanted when you got a fresh catch-in and then freeze it for manufacturing use later on.
Yes, big deal. And after that discovery in the 1960s, the production of surimi-based items just shot up even more.
Oh, yeah.
Imitation crab specifically was privately invented in 1975 by Sugino, Y. Sugino, and K. Osaki. And Osaki's father had founded a company that commercially processed surimi in 1928. They were looking for a cheaper alternative of the much desired but very expensive crab. And Osaki believed that with a little chafing and red food coloring, they could make their product look like actual crab legs. Yes. They weren't the only company to develop imitation crab around this time in Japan, but they were certainly one of the biggest, certainly the names that come up the most when you're digging into the history of imitation crab. In the early 80s, imitation crab made its way to mainstream United States, manufactured by the Japanese company Yamasa Enterprises. And it was pretty much an immediate success, making an annual $250 million in the United States.
Ooh.
By 1986, going from 100,000 pounds to 100 million pounds in a few short years. Wow. As popularity and demand grew in America, their production, the production in America, surpassed Japan's production. And American companies, they began exporting to Japan. Not all was well, though. Here's a quote from a 1987 Chicago Tribune article. "But not since classic Coke has any food caused as much talk about the real thing. Many people want to know, who is this imposter? And why is it causing so much controversy?"
Gosh. All right.
I know. And a part of this controversy was due to the lack of regulations requiring restaurants, groceries, and so on to label imitation crab as long as it was fresh. So as long as it was fresh, they didn't have to really differentiate. This did change. Eventually, imitation crab, or seafood product became the norm of labeling. But yeah, that changed again later, which we'll get to. And also, I just want to put this in here. I read a whole Atlas Obscura article about the origins of the crab rangoon, made, with imitation crab frequently. Future episode.
Yeah.
But essentially, I've never really thought about how interesting of a food product this is. But essentially, Trader Vic's plus tiki culture plus the development of Chinese-American cuisine all came together
to create this, this deep-fried wonton pastry that contains cream cheese and imitation crab.
Yeah.
What a whirlwind, right?
Now I want to do an episode on cream cheese, because then I went on a rabbit hole about that, and I was like, stop it.
But, interesting. Oh, I would love to do an episode on cream cheese. Oh,
yes.
Yay. Okay.
Yes.
Okay, concentrate. Part of what spurred all of this production of surimi-based products here in the United States during the 1980s was changing fishery laws in the late 1970s that previously had allowed foreign fishers to get pretty close to American shores. But these new laws pushed them out, and in Alaska specifically, like 200 miles from the shoreline. And so that allowed these American fisheries to really capitalize on the pollock, the Alaskan pollock in those waters. And that, it was just this dovetail that happened right as imitation crab was taking off in the United States. And suddenly these producers were like, oh man, we can get all of this like relatively easy to catch fish, and we can make a pretty decent profit off of it by turning it into this stuff that there's now a market for.
Something else that helped was the popularization of the California roll. Invented by a Japanese chef in Canada and using crab stick as one of the ingredients. The California roll also helped introduce sushi at large to the American mainstream. Many, many rolls that did incorporate imitation crab, they were intentional because a lot of Americans at the time were a bit nervous about eating raw seafood. I can remember the first time I had sushi, which was in high school, and I told my mom, and she was like, oh, you ate raw fish? And now she'll eat sushi, but like, rolls like that. I want to do one on the California roll, too. So many future episodes to come back to.
Yes. Yeah. Who knew? Imitation crab. Thank you. You're a gold mine.
The crab that keeps on giving. In 1993, Jay Park started Surimi School at Oregon State University, which is an annual event at the OSU Seafood Lab. And it culminates in a tasting of all kinds of surimi products, scallops, hot dogs, and desserts.
Wow. Desserts.
Yes. If anyone has any more information on this, the most recent article I could find was pretty old. So I'm not sure if it's still going on. But any listener has any information. Also, the article I found that in had a Curb Your Enthusiasm clip. Which any time research allows me to watch a clip from a comedy is great. But it's basically Larry David arguing with Cheryl about how he talks during sex. And she's like, it's not even dirty talk. You bring up imitation crab. And he's like, imitation crab is interesting. More people should know about it. It made me laugh. Man, I actually have a pretty good Larry David impression. I really didn't do it there. Future. In the future. The FDA allowed for the dropping of imitation in 2006 labeling. Yeah. Instead allowing for this description, crab-flavored seafood made with surimi, a fully cooked fish protein.
Okay. Hmm. Still accurate. That is a very long way of saying imitation, but
yes.
Sure.
Yeah, okay. A 2018 Russia Beyond article claims that crab stick salad is one of the top three items on Russian tables on New Year's, and they called it the Russian version of Crab Louis. The article goes on to claim that Russian women came up with this dish in the 1980s. So again, any listeners, if you got more information on that, would love to hear.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Also, as of 2018, new technologies to recapture some of the proteins and other nutrients lost during the water treatment part of processing surimi were debuted, which helps reduce waste. Yay.
Mm-hmm.
Although, less yay, overfishing and climate change have led to steadily decreasing production of surimi products since the 1980s, despite continually increasing demand, which means that prices are rising.
Yes. And that's about where we are with imitation crab. However, I did want to end this one on a slightly different note because I found what is one of the most beautiful pieces of art I've ever found while researching an episode. It is called Fantacrab, Fantasy of Surimi. And I would like Lauren to take a crack at describing it to you.
Okay. So I don't know where you found this. And I don't know what Fantacrab is, if that's a brand or...
It's a brand,
It's a brand? Okay. Uh-huh. Oh, I do see the little reserved mark next to it. Okay, cool. So this is an image of like a... Oh, what's the word? Like a collage or what's the term when you have like a whole bunch of tiles that make up an image? Yeah. Oh,
like a mosaic.
Oh, Yeah, like a mosaic. Sure. Yeah, no, this is a mosaic of surimi products. So it's the image in the mosaic is this very kingly King Triton kind of thing with a flowing beard and a noble crown. And it looks like he might be riding upon a dolphin or like a killer whale, carrying his trident. Through a sea, a dark and storming sea. But all of these elements, I cannot impress upon you enough, are mosaiced out of surimi products. So I can see in the crown and in the orca, there's some crab claws, perhaps lobster claws. It's hard to tell. The beard and his hair are made of little surimi shrimps. His body appears to be crab stick. It's the very best fake seafood mosaic I have ever seen in my life.
I feel very confident we can say that now.
Thought was put into it. It's glorious.
Oh, certainly. yes. Hopefully we can post this or go look it up. It is a thing to behold.
Yeah, it is truly a fantasy of surimi.
I believe there's a whole story. Like, the company had, like, a whole Neptune rides upon the waters. And there's a whole thing. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. I mean, he does. I'm not going to take that away from him. So no matter how much surimi he's made out of, that is his right.
Oh, well, thank you, Lauren, for indulging me. And excellent job describing this.
You're welcome. Thank you for providing the opportunity.
Oh, I knew it had to be shared. I knew it. It's one of those things, the second you see it, it's like love at first sight, but with, you know, a piece of seafood.
But with more imitation seafood. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, my heck. Well, yeah, so we do have some listener mail for you.
We do, but first we have one more quick break for a word from our sponsor. And we're back. Thank you, sponsor.
Yes, thank you.
And we're back with listener mail. It's a crab movement in there.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I was torn between, I was like, I should do an imitation of us doing listener mail, but then that broke my brain.
Oh.
So I backed out quick because I think I might not have returned from that.
Yeah, no, no.
And then I was going to do like a Fanta crab. There were a lot of options I could have taken for this one, is what I'm saying.
I look forward to a King Triton Neptune moment sometime in the future.
But. Oh, yeah. It's coming.
Cool.
Oh, yeah. But in the meantime, Marjorie wrote, my grandparents owned an almond ranch a mile or two from the Franzia Winery near Escalon, California, and were friends with the Franzia and Gallo families. Yeah. When my grandparents retired and moved into town behind my junior high school, I would go over to their house after school to help with chores, and my grandmother would regale me with stories of life on the farm and the stories of Escalon. The Franzia and Gallo families provided some of the subject matter of those stories, including how one of the Gallo brothers courted his wife on my grandparents' honeysuckle-covered porch over bowls of popcorn.
Huh.
His penny pinching was legendary in the Central Valley. Thanks for bringing back those cherished memories of spending time with my grandmother and listening to her stories. You might want to think about doing an episode on the Gallo family and their influence on the American wine industry. It is a murder mystery with bootlegging wrapped up with some strong-arming and unbridled ambition through the generation story.
Oof. Yes. Yes.
Into it. That's really cool.
Yeah. Oh, that's fascinating. All of that is fascinating, top to bottom. And now I'm like, oh man, I should recommend the Gallo family story to American Shadows, that murder podcast I'm doing. Because
you know, should.
Huh. Such intrigue. Any bootlegging story.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Katie wrote, if every single one of your Australian listeners doesn't write in to tell you about Goon of Fortune, I will eat my hat. Goon of Fortune is almost a rite of passage game for often underage Australians, where you get the bag out of the box and peg it to the Hills Hoist, a rotary clothesline. Everyone sits in a circle under the clothesline and someone spins it. Whoever is sitting under the bag when it comes to a stop gets the wine poured into their mouth from the spigot. It is not exactly a game of skill, but it is a cheap and fast way to get a party started. And oh so patriotic because it combines two Australian inventions, cask wine and the Hills Hoist. I should say the boxed wine, cask wine in Australia is often called goon, particularly when the wine is not of good quality. The bag is called a goon bag, hence the name of the game, Goon of Fortune. Say it like Wheel of Fortune. Also, and maybe I'm revealing too much here, but cask wine was always the sensible choice to take to parties in my youth because you can blow up an empty bag to use as a pillow at the end of the night. Actually, there's even a sculpture in the Civic Center in Canberra, which is called the Goon Bag. It's a big silver pillow. I'm not sure if the artist meant it to be a goon bag, but I've never heard it called anything else. And yes, Australia does need to work on its drinking culture. I drink much more responsibly now, but still would never sniff at wine from a box.
I love all of this. Oh, my gosh.
Oh, that's great. Yes.
And you do not have to eat your hat because I believe we've heard from every Australian.
every Australian, period. Not yes. only the ones who listen to the show.
It got out quick. They didn't mention Gouda Fortune, which I love. And we're going to share even more stories of this later because they are all wonderful and make us smile.
Yes, absolutely. So good.
Huh. Yeah. I can't believe I've never thought of using the bag for something, like anything. Because I know some people said they like use it to, like a footstool, blow it up and use a footstool, like all kinds of things.
Okay. Yeah.
See?
Reduce, reuse, recycle. That's great.
Yes. We're all about it. All about it. Thanks to both of those listeners for writing. If you would like to write to us, you can. Our email is hello@saverpod.com.
We're also on social media. You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram @SaverPod, and we do hope to hear from you. Saver is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, you can visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. Thanks, as always, to our super producers, Dylan Fagan and Andrew Howard. Thanks to you for listening, and we hope that lots more good things are coming your way.